Hi, everyone. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholics talk about books and movies that they love and the thread of one reality that they see underneath it.
That's right. And reality is a good word for today's podcast.
Yeah.
In which we are going to talk about the movie Inception, which was written and directed by Christopher Nolan.
Yes.
And this is episode 16.
Ugh.
Yeah.
I know.
16.
So close to 20. I know.
Right, right. So, let's talk Inception. I suppose we better... Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I have some listener feedback.
Oh, fantastic.
Shall I just read it,
I guess? Yeah, go right ahead.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Scott and Julie. First time commenter, long time listener. You've made me have some deep thoughts about stories. Each of us needs time and space for meditation, reflection, and calm. Thank God it's so. In fact, this requirement tells us that we are not made only for work, but also to think, reflect, or simply to follow a story with our minds and hearts, a story that we can connect with, in a sense, get lost in, to then find ourselves enriched. Keep going. Love the show. Pope Benedict the 16th. okay, well, that's really...
Wow.
I like our reach. That's, you know, okay, actually, the bulk of that was from his vacation address from his balcony.
Oh, fantastic.
I think he was on vacation, but he was actually... Then he went on, as Hannah said, he goes, oh, he's got to ruin it by talking about the Bible. he was encouraging people to try a little book of the Bible that you haven't read before while you're on vacation. Because mm-hmm. he was saying you can read them in an hour, and there's a lot in there that you wouldn't expect. But
well,
it struck
great.
Me that, you know, he must have been listening.
He must have been. Must have been.
Well, kind of like you were saying, if he says he's putting something in the pool room, then we'll know, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I'll search the internet every day for the words pool room.
Yeah, because then we know he's watched The Castle.
That's right. That's right.
That's right. Okay, well, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, that was a good interruption.
At the lapse of reality, right? All about us.
That's right, which is the perfect segue into our movie, which, now, how are we going to describe this movie?
I think I have a brief introduction, and then unfortunately it's probably all spoilers from
great. Okay. And yeah. That's what I felt too. So
okay. Most people probably heard of it because it was a huge hit last summer, and I was happy not only because I love the movie, but because it was so completely original. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a sequel. And so I was like, see, Hollywood, you can still have an original movie.
They and it's standalone unless they're already working on Inception 2.
They better not be.
I hope not. You know?
Well, I think that screenplay took Christopher Nolan 10 years, 9 or 10 years
wow.
to get to the point it is. So mm-hmm. probably not. But basically, I was surprised because after we saw it, Rose said it's the ultimate heist movie. And I hadn't thought of it that way before, but she's right.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, in this movie, you can steal people's dreams. You not take them away, but you can enter their dreams and you can take secrets out. And so there's obviously an industry for industrial espionage. Mm-hmm. And we meet Cobb, who's the main guy in it, and his sidekick, Arthur, who's kind of like the director said, or the actor, Joseph Gordon-Levitt,
mm-hmm.
said he thought of him as a producer. Cobb has the idea, and then he puts together all the details that makes it happen. And they work on stealing things, and they come across a very, very rich man who says, I want to do the opposite, Inception. I want to plant an idea, which mm-hmm. at first Cobb rejects that idea because it's so dangerous. Arthur says it can't be done. Cobb says he knows it can. And so basically they agree to do this. Because he's very anxious, for reasons we don't understand yet, to get back to the United States. He's legally barred from going there. And this guy says he can make it happen. So they put together the team, and while they're putting together the team, you start to understand how it works to go into dreams, and then they start to pull off the heist.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an extremely brief description.
And super a good one, yeah.
Movie. Oh, thank you. And in fact, I was surprised because I'd heard of people who said, I didn't understand what happened. I understood. I was hanging on by the skin of my teeth the whole first time I watched it, because it is, oh man, fast moving, complicated. It's like watching three or four James Bond slash heist movies in one.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole time there's this tension over whether Cobb can pull it off and whether the guy will keep his promise at the end.
Right.
As well as a couple other things. But and in fact, I have a friend, and I think I mentioned this before when we were talking about it, but he won't even watch it again.
Hmm.
He was really confused. He didn't know what was going on. And this guy's super smart. And later I was thinking, oh, I wonder if this touched a different nerve with him somehow.
I wonder if.
Because he won't even hardly mention the movie's name.
Yeah, this is my second time watching it. Watched it a couple days ago, and I watched it with the whole family. So my 11-year-old daughter understood it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yesterday I said, I need to do the podcast tomorrow. And she says, Dad, that was a good movie.
She has good taste.
Yeah, so she enjoyed it a lot.
Well,
all four of us did. Yeah, all four of us liked it.
It was so – I was amazed at how – complex it was and how carefully they guided you through each step, so that even though it was moving really fast, and like I said, sometimes I was hanging on by the skin of my teeth going, whose dream is this? Which we could talk more about later, but I could follow the whole thing basically. It was my third time of watching it. Rose saw it the night it came out. She's a huge Christopher Nolan fan. And she was coming back to Chicago the next day, but she stayed up to go to the midnight viewing. We'd hardly even heard of it. And she came back that next day and went, we are all going to see this tonight. No arguments. And so we all came back just going, oh my gosh, our brains exploded. How are we going to go to sleep? There's so much to talk about.
Yep, yep.
And so.
Yeah, just so, let's see, Christopher Nolan, he wrote, or... let's see. I'm just looking at his list here. So he did Batman, The Dark Knight, and then Dark Knight Rises is the new one.
Right.
Batman Begins. The Prestige, which is one of my favorite books.
Ah, yes. I haven't read the book. The movie was good, but there wasn't enough characterization. It left me cold character-wise. And
the book is different enough from the movie that there are still surprises to be had. I would recommend, if anybody's interested or has their interest piqued by the movie, go ahead and read the book, because it's by Christopher Priest, and it's told in a journal or an epistolary novel from those two characters' point of view.
Okay.
And I listened to it on audio. The audiobook is terrific. And every now and then the narrator, because everything's in the first person from one of those two people, they would say something. And then I remember stopping and backing up, because I'm like, did he say what I thought he said? Because he said something that doesn't make any sense unless you know what's going on. And those are the kinds of clues that he leaves throughout the book. And then you're like,
so it might be better reading it, actually.
The book is actually, it's better, and the surprises are different. So,
well, that would be good, because I hadn't, which we're talking about a different movie now, but I hadn't really foreseen the surprises necessarily. But because I couldn't connect with either of the characters, I was really left distanced from the movie. And so I wasn't very fond of it. Mm-hmm. Although it's clear that Christopher Nolan is such a smart, interesting movie maker that he makes the audience rise to his expectations. And because he clearly loves story, you do. I'm always excited to see when he's got a movie coming out, because it's going to be more than you expect.
Yeah, for sure. I've enjoyed everything, just looking at this list. And it's interesting to me as well that on the very top of this list is Man of Steel. And it says filming for 2013.
Okay, now he's letting me down.
Maybe it's not Superman. Let's click on it.
Oh yeah, sure. That's right.
Yeah, it's Superman.
I've never been that crazy about Superman.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, you know, the Richard Donner movie came out with Christopher Reeve, and that was all fine. And it was, you know, one of the first superhero movies back in the day. Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, I'm like, how many times can we tell the story? Now, if anyone could do it interestingly, he could. But
Oh, look, he's not directing it. He is. What is he? Maybe he's
producing it or wrote it.
Story. Story okay. is, he's just got a story credit on it. Okay. So he's not, yeah, he said, hey, this would be a good idea, and then moved on.
Someone took it. Well, he and his brother work together a lot, don't they? I think his brother does a lot of screenplay or writing on his stuff.
Okay.
Again,
Jonathan
this is
Nolan.
My film source, Rose.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't look this up, but she's always been very enthusiastic about the fact that the reason he got into the Batman movies is they both, as boys, got into the Batman comics and loved that whole determination for truth and justice.
Yeah.
And so that's what they got hooked into. And then he went on and made other movies too, of course.
Right. But Batman's always been my favorite superhero.
Yeah. He,
I really,
he
you know,
the
yeah.
superpower.
Yeah. He doesn't have the superpowers and, you know, he uses his brain a lot. And
yeah.
he is dark, you know, and mysterious like myself.
He is. I've always known there were those deeper levels to Scott.
That's right. If I get called away, you know what I'm doing.
Yes, the time must be very different there in Idaho because I won't be able to see that bat signal. It's light here.
That's right. Well, but we digress, yes.
Yes, I was going to say, speaking of lairs, I think we have to start spoilers, which...
Yeah, I agree. We need to jump right into that otherwise.
Because, there's so many layers, both thematically and film-wise, to this. I mean, when you're just diving down through those layers of dreams that they've constructed.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is when the movie starts, you start down two levels of dreams.
Right.
And you don't even know what's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, you start down further than that, but by the time you're into the movie, you've forgotten the very beginning.
Yeah, right. And
that
this
bookend is
this amazing special effects that they have. Strange things start to happen, and you're like, you know.
Yeah, and they start flipping back and forth between two different stories where they're...
He's speaking to somebody at a conference room table. And then suddenly you flip to him sleeping, sitting in a chair above a giant bathtub.
Yeah, and so, Lucas Haas is there, and they're kind of in this seedy, like it looks like Indonesia or something to me.
Right.
Third world kind of place. And then they go back to the conference room, which is in a super elegant Japanese temple, modernized.
Yeah.
With Ken Watanabe, is that how you say it?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
I love him.
Yeah,
and they
too.
Say that this, since I was reading the Wikipedia page, this is the first major part he's had that's in an English-speaking movie.
Oh, really?
All the way. Hmm. Although, I don't know how that can be because he was in The Last Samurai.
Oh, okay.
But I guess he was playing a Japanese character, not an English-speaking character.
Ah.
He was saying he tried to change the way his character was presenting himself for every part of the movie he was in.
Hmm. Oh,
Asian
interesting.
At the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, thinking about that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so what you discover is that they are dreaming. They're actually all on a train, and they've entered each other's dreams, and through some technology, which luckily they never bother explaining because nobody really cares.
Yeah, nobody really cares. It's a little machine that puts them to sleep, and
they were hired by somebody to steal this guy's industrial secrets, but the Ken Watanabe character. It starts with an S. I can't remember it. Anyway, so then he turns around and wants to hire Cobb to plant an idea in someone's head.
Right. Yep. So he's way smart. He knows what's going on while it's happening. And he doesn't let Cobb in on it until it's very end. He's like, oh, this is not real. And I know who you are and I know what you're doing.
Wow, and, two layers of dreams.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
So, yeah, so that was impressive. And yeah, the whole heist aspect is awfully cool. I mean, it's action-packed, it's tense.
Oh,
and
my
even
gosh.
Though, even though they're in dreams, you always feel like they're in peril. They always are.
Oh my gosh, yes. And at the end, when they all kind of, skipping around, when they wake up, though, from the end, they're all just sitting there not saying anything. And people were like, and the director, too, said he left that rather ambiguous. They don't talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And I was like, To me, that seemed natural because you go through all that that they went through, and then you just wake up on an airplane. You're just like, holy
crap, right.
What just happened?
Well, I assumed that they didn't talk to each other because they didn't want the subject of what they just did, who was also in the same room.
That's
They pretended they didn't know each other all the way going into the plane, and they can't.
They're just giving each other meaningful glances.
While you've been asleep, we had a party, and we all know each other now.
Yeah, exactly.
So I just assumed that they were just continuing to act.
Yeah. Well, so what happens is they, which most people know if they're still listening, but they go ahead and put the team together, and what you discover is that Cobb's got a huge secret. And his wife haunts his subconscious, and he can't control her, which you can't control your subconscious. That point's made early. And she is the mysterious woman who shows up at the beginning and messes up the whole heist that they were on that introduces you to that idea of dreaming and actively moving around in dreams.
Right. And I think that's what makes this movie work so well. I mean, everything we've talked up to now has been cool.
Right.
But the human story of Cobb and his wife, I think it's the glue that holds everything together and makes it a deep, meaningful experience.
And his children.
And his children, right. Yep.
Because basically he's been framed for the murder of his wife by his wife.
By his wife, yeah.
Yeah, who was crazy at the time, and which is making it sound so much more shallow than it is. Mm-hmm. And he can't go back to the United States or he'll be charged with murder. And so he's had to flee, leaving his children with their grandmother, and who you assume, I guess, is his wife's mother.
Mm-hmm.
But and so every so often his memories will show you those little children in one little pose looking at some digging for something outside and then being called away, and you don't ever see their faces.
Yeah, and he won't look at their faces. I mean, even when he had an opportunity at one time during the movie to see their faces, he wouldn't do it because he didn't want to see them in the dream.
I think because he was afraid he couldn't leave them then.
Yeah.
And he knew it wasn't real, and he wasn't going to let himself not believe in something that wasn't true. And that's really the essence of this movie. It's about love, and it's about truth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about guilt.
Right.
And you can't find any bigger themes than that because the person that they're trying to plant the dream in also has suffered. He has suffered a severe lack of love ever since his mother died when he was 11. And that's made so clear. Oh my gosh, you just lie there. You just sit there hating that old man lying in that hospital bed when they're checking out this guy because they're going to get the lay of the land of the characters around him so they can find out how to plant this idea and what he might respond to and what's his relationship with his father like. Mm-hmm. His father's on his deathbed and he is treating this guy like dirt.
Mm-hmm.
All he wants is a kind word, and the guy won't even give him a kind glance. And when he dies, he could hardly move and was in horrible pain, but he took the trouble to call me over and make sure that he said something to me. And the only word I could understand was disappointed. And your heart just breaks for this guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And which makes it, if you don't mind if I diverge for a second, which this time through, and I may have picked that up before, and it may have been so obvious to everyone else, but the third layer of the dream they go into in the heist is actually his dream, his innermost dreams. And it's frozen cold in the mountains. And it's supposed to be a hospital, but it looks like a huge fortress.
Hmm.
And every layer of dreams that you go into reflects something of the dreamer themselves. So the dreamer right above him was Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Was that right? Was that his mind?
Yeah, I think so. I think you're correct. Yeah.
Yeah. And so his was kind of flashy and shiny and very slick, because that's the kind of character he is. It was a very nice hotel and, you know, so kind of transient also. But this one, to me, I just suddenly looked at it and went, oh my gosh, this is where he's hiding his innermost secrets. He's been frozen cold by the lack of love. His heart's like a fortress, so nobody can get in and hurt him. And his people aren't like just walking around the hotel pulling a gun out. They are actively armed soldiers.
Yeah.
I was just like, yeah, that's what that does to you.
Yeah, they said during the movie that some of these people, because breaking into dreams is something they have to deal with, you can get trained to, you can train your subconscious to attack any intruders.
Yeah.
And this guy has been trained.
Yeah.
Because he's the son of the CEO of a major corporation.
Mm-hmm. Killian Murphy is the actor who played him.
He
researched Robert Murdoch.
Oh, really? Sons.
Yeah, he didn't. He just said to look at people who were raised with this very, very powerful father.
Mm-hmm.
That's all he said. But I thought, oh yeah, that seems like a, I could see that
being a
modern day connection.
Yeah. Yeah. And the idea of the idea was a big theme in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that Inception is so difficult is because they need to make whatever idea they're trying to implant needs to appear to the subject as if it was their idea.
Right.
And that's why it's so difficult. So if you introduce it in the incorrect way, it'll never be absorbed by the subject.
Right.
And then further, Cobb is the main character's name. Mm-hmm. He was explaining that an idea can completely change the character of this person. He said, you know, if we go in there and we implant this, we can't predict for certain how that's going to affect this person's life. And that was an interesting thing too.
Well, he kept saying over and over, an idea is like a virus. It spreads and it will, somewhere I wrote it down, but it spreads and it changes you forever.
Mm-hmm.
And it, oh gosh, I wish I'd have written it down. That basically it changes you. It was said more mm-hmm. elegantly. And the thing I did like about this movie also, Rose says this is a trait of his that I've never really noticed until now, but he'll take a line or two and different characters will say it, or sometimes the same character. It'll be repeated two or three times in the movie, because what you realize is each time it's said, you suddenly realize the significance even more, or it's changed in significance. Yeah.
Well, in this movie, for sure. I mean, I don't know if it was said by multiple characters, but it was certainly felt by Killian Murphy's character.
Mm-hmm.
He had an idea in his head that his father hated him.
Yeah. And I believe it was a true one.
Yeah, sure. But when he was able at the end to deal with that idea, that's what changed him, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've seen this movie, like I said, three times. And mm-hmm. every time when that safe is open and he pulls that pinwheel out, you can hear it in my voice now. I'm just like, because that's the love that he wanted. That was the affirmation that he needed.
Right, right.
To make him a whole person. And I also think it was brilliant to have that kind of con man, thief character, Ames, watch. Because when they think they can't do it a little earlier, he's like, oh, pity. I thought we had this. I really wanted to see what happened.
Right.
It's the audience at that point. It's like, no, we have to see. And so he's just standing there watching, waiting to push that button, but going, come on, hurry up.
And
he's like, yes, it worked. And that idea thing and how you plant it, what you see is that Cobb's, they'll talk about, it kind of ties into, you don't really understand people the way you think you do, because until you get deeper, because when you see Ken Watanabe's character and he's like, I have to plant an idea. I want this giant conglomerate to break up their companies.
Mm-hmm.
You think, it's a competitive thing. Well, when he explains later, he says, well, it's because they completely will control power globally, and that's a dangerous thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he wants to compete, but more he's looking at the big picture. That's not a healthy thing, is the way it's presented.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's almost an altruistic / opportunistic thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look deeper at Robert Fisher, you think, oh, he's just a rich kid, blah, blah, blah. Well, then you realize, well, no, he's got a huge personal problem. Nobody's who you think they are.
Right.
We don't get to know everybody, but mm-hmm. the people you do get to know and you see below the surface, they're more.
Yeah, they're acting a certain way because of this virus of an idea that's invaded them somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's like, you know, three different people are affected by that during the movie. Three different ideas.
Yeah.
At least, you know, I'm just thinking Robert Fisher, Cobb, and Watanabe.
Yeah, well, and Mal, the wife. Her name is Mallory, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I always just thought of her, and if you've seen the movie, you'd understand why I think this way, is that she never was real. She was a projection of Cobb. It was Cobb's memories of her is what she was.
Right.
Yeah. But you're right. You're right. But she was also infected by this idea. But and her the idea that infected her was that she, this wasn't real. Where she was wasn't real was the idea that hurt her. And she couldn't get around it. She kept thinking, well, I need to break out of this unreality.
Yeah, because when you're in the dreams, if you kill yourself or die, then you wake up.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knows that real well. It's obviously common knowledge. And then, except for the fact that when they go into the big heist, in order to go three levels down and dream that, sleep that deeply, you have to be sedated. So if you kill yourself or die, then you wind up down in limbo, which is down in your subconscious, and you can never escape unless someone comes to get you. And so that's the danger, is they're used to the fact that, well, I'll just let him die, or he's in terrible pain, he's been hurt, I'll kill him. It's like, no, you have to keep people alive. And so, yeah, when Mal gets this idea planted, she kills herself because she thinks she's not in reality, and nothing that Cobb does can make her stop thinking that. And that's how he's learned how dangerous an idea can be if it's deeply planted, and how it comes to define you, is what he says.
Right, right.
And so for me, I was looking at that because this looks at what is reality and are your ideas good or bad? What's true? Because they have to go three layers down in this dream and break into a big safe, which is how they're visualizing for us where the mind hides its deepest, darkest secrets that they don't want anyone to have. And as a Catholic, I just look at that and go, yeah, how do you know what's true? I mean, that's the question I had before I became a Christian. How do you know God's there?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you dig down to those, like, say, three or four levels and scrape away the stuff that's inconsequential or hiding what's real? I don't know if that's got an answer, but it's a question that each person has to face for themselves.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, and it is a question that's, you know, with postmodernism and all that stuff, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, hey, you know, everything's true. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's almost like, you know, we're all in our own dream, and all of our dreams are valid, and everybody's right, you know.
And all the things that we used to hold as common truth that were just even from natural law, maybe, are questioned. And the thing, speaking of movies, that really kind of bothered me and made me think about it again was that Planet of the Apes movie that just came out, Rising, where it goes back and it's like a prequel to the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, I've seen ads. Yeah.
Well, I've been reading reviews about it because I saw the preview and I was like, oh, okay, too tenderhearted. Can't watch how, you know, Caesar the monkey is abused so that he hates people, blah, blah, blah. But what I was reading in some reviews is that it's a great, great movie. But at the end, because you have to have the uplifting we won feeling, you're cheering against the human race. You're supporting the monkeys that took over, basically, or apes that take over. And Stephen Graydenis, I don't know if that's how you say his name, but he was saying, it doesn't mean it's not a great movie. He goes, but it is a comment on our culture, that everybody in the audience was going, yeah, all right. Whereas in, you know, the first one, it's the tragic fall of man when you see that iconic symbol that's half buried, that man was his own downfall.
Right.
It's a sad thing. And I was like, look how far we've come when that, I don't know if you could have made a movie like that where people would have cheered for it in the 70s or 60s or whenever that first movie came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't go back and guess, but I know that a coworker came in and went, wow, great movie. He goes, it is the movie that makes you cheer to see the downfall of humanity in general. Mm-hmm. And he was laughing about it. And I was like, yeah, it's just a movie and it's not a big deal, but it kind of, science fiction is a, you know, it has its tendrils out there to where we're going a lot of the time.
Yeah, it sure does.
And it's kind of a troubling thing that we already don't value life enough that we care about unborn babies,
mm-hmm.
or old people sometimes, where we go, well, it's better to just die, blah, 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 than, you know, to have my conception of what's a dignified life go on for you.
Yeah.
I don't know if those threads all go together, but for me, they're just kind of all floating out there going, this is a troubling thing.
Yeah.
It's just another sign of the times,
I'm sitting here thinking about it, and it is troubling. I mean, you think about all the, you know, it's also interesting as you talk about Planet of the Apes, how we're going through a similar time right now. When the original Planet of the Apes came out, it was a similar time, you know, economically and things, mm-hmm. to where we are right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, it was. You're right.
You know, it's you know, science fiction often comments on, well, it's always a comment about humanity, whether there's aliens in there or whatever.
Right.
It's always talking about us.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, though.
What makes it so brilliant.
Yeah. And it's what makes it worthwhile often, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's interesting that the Planet of the Apes is something that, you know, I'm trying to think of what the connection is. But, you know, I know in today's society here in the United States, we're constantly inundated with information about how terrible we are for, mm-hmm. you know, how terrible Christianity is in particular. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's almost a day, you know, almost every day in the news, oh, yeah. you hear something negative about either somebody who's Christian has done something terrible, or something in history has happened,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, that they've discovered, or, you know, and the result is not, well, you know, you can't judge a philosophy by its abuse. You know, the people
right.
that are doing this are not following the precepts that they're supposed to be following.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a huge problem.
I can't remember who said this, but might have been Fulton Sheen, who's so smart. But somebody like that said, you can't judge a medicine by the patient who pours it down the drain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know,
right.
it's, if they're not going to follow it. Well, and that's the kind of thing, it's interesting when you say that, because, yeah, that's judging the human race. Those are think about it. If you're an American, you're automatically, according to the media and a lot of things, you're a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a Christian, you're a bad guy. If you're Catholic, even more so. The mm-hmm. other Christians may gather together to judge you also, which I guess is something Mormons probably also feel
and
could identify with heavily. Mm-hmm. If you're white in this country, thumbs down, you know, and then you've got your mail. You've got the whole package. Me, at least I'm a woman. I spend all my time going, I don't care about women's studies, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Stop grouping me in with a lot of angry people.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's kind of interesting to be no one would ever walk up to you and go, oh, you're the downtrodden.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this constant barrage of negativity that has to be combated. And maybe that's why I like this movie Inception so much, because it's about the triumph of the human spirit, really.
Yeah, and I agree with you. It really is. It's a incredibly action-packed movie that has this deep thread that goes straight through it. And at the end, you feel really good. If you believe, you know, we discussed this, it's ambiguous at the end.
Yes. Orson Scott Card is still, he still will every so often in movies write a diatribe against Christopher Nolan for his ending of this movie.
Says, oh, really?
It's just like he gave the audience the finger. Uh-huh. He was really pissed off about it.
Because he felt like he was saying, well, this is a dream?
Well, he said he didn't have the courage of his convictions. He just wanted to play with the audience at the end and put in a clever little mind game instead of saying, come on, we know it was real. And when you read interviews with him, he says, well, yes, I have young children. I feel like it was real. And that's the whole, when he talks about developing the script, he said he was trying to think, what is the thing that would make somebody fight so hard against a comfortable dream that he would rather sink into and be happy in for a hard truth? And he said, well, by that time in developing it, he had children. And he knew his children is what he would fight for. And I was like, yes, because that's the truth of the human spirit. The people that you love who are depending on you and who love you back, that's what makes you want to go, where's the truth? And really, when you think about how, sorry, I'm going to take another huge leap just at this moment. But when you think about how he is in a prison that he has built of his memories, that is actually his guilt. He's trying to lock that guilt in a cage and he can't. He constantly revisits it. It constantly breaks into everything. And every place he is in a dream, he sees his children somewhere or he sees his wife, which is his guilt somewhere. Everywhere there's guilt until he actually makes himself face it and say it out loud.
Confession. And right.
Yeah, you mentioned confession. And I was like, as a Catholic, I just sat there. Practically, and of course, maybe you can hear it in my voice now. I'm just going, that's the power of confession.
Yeah, and it sure is. Yeah.
And admitting to yourself and admitting to a higher power, you know, here's what I did, and I'm sorry. I didn't, even if you didn't mean it, and he didn't, he had the best intentions. But through an accident, he was responsible for his wife's death. And not directly. He didn't murder her. He was trying to fix it, change it. But yeah. And that's what the movie's about.
Right.
It's only when he frees himself from that, that it doesn't matter if the top is still spinning when he leaves. Because Christopher Nolan's like, to him, the whole point is, he's like, the point is not if the top is still spinning. The point is that he has moved on. And I was thinking about that. And I went, well, now you're saying if truth does or doesn't even matter anymore. And what we talking around the house kind of came to, because for me, there's a lot of other little signs. The top starts to wobble, which it does in the beginning of the movie, right before it falls over at some long point when he's showing it to Ariadne. There were two sets of kids cast, younger, two years younger. But beyond that is, it's not that he's leaving reality behind. It's that that was Mel's totem in the first place. He's able to leave her behind. He doesn't need her totem anymore. He understands what reality is deep down, and he can move on and live in the real world.
Right.
Whether that's specious or not, because I want it to be that way, but otherwise it's just nihilistic. It's nihilistic.
Yeah, and that's, kind of, you know, it's something that I think as Catholics, we sort of naturally shun the nihilistic philosophy, you know, that pervades again, you know, the society that we're in. And, you know, meaninglessness is something that people often say that, you know, we got no problem with meaninglessness. And, but, you know, I think ultimately people don't live that way. No. If you honestly think that your life is meaningless and everything is meaningless, then what's the point of anything? You know, you eventually, if you think about it, you know, you're going to reach that kind of a point, you know?
Yeah.
And well, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
No,
go
I'm
ahead.
Just, yeah, I'm just saying that to me, you know, this movie sort of encapsulates that. In life, you can look at it in a way and interpret it in a way in which it's meaningless. And that is the idea that's like the virus, you know, that idea affects how you behave and everything. Yeah. Whereas if you are coming from the point where things are meaningful, which I think is the only logical thing in my opinion,
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Then, that is an idea that infuses your life with meaning as well. And it gets you to the truth.
Yes. Well, and I was trying to remember, speaking of lesser known books of the Bible or books we don't read, there is a book of the Bible that is written all from the point of view of what's the point of life? You might as well eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And is it Ecclesiastes, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah.
Yeah, they're one of those wisdom books.
Okay.
Because the person, it's fairly short, but the whole way through is basically written by the narrator who's saying, well, life is meaningless. So how do you live if life is meaningless? What should we occupy our time with?
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going to have to go look and maybe read that book, because that's the opposite point of view. Because if that's the case, then yeah, eat, drink, and be merry.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, you know, if we talk about today's American society, you know, I don't know how it is in the rest of the world, but it sure seems like it's the same way, mm-hmm. is that people are progressively, I guess I'm going to use that word on purpose, mm-hmm. Progressively mm-hmm. moving towards that point of view
mm-hmm.
and rejecting the point of view that things are meaningful, to the point where they're aggressively pushing it out of every institution that they can push it out of.
Man, no kidding, right?
And, right. So, but there's no, you know, in this society, we need to get to a point where we're all just getting along, you know. And, you know, I guess you could call them militant atheists. You know, what do you call, like, Christopher yeah. Hitchens and Richard Dawkins?
I just call them angry atheists.
Angry atheists militant, is a good I word. I mean, and what they're angry about is that they believe that they've been told how to live and how to feel guilty and everything for so long by Christians, that if Christianity is not true, that makes them furious. And, I certainly got that out of God Is Not Great by Christopher Hitchens, okay. that book. I'm certainly getting that anger out of there. So, but why, it's okay, you know, I just wish we could get to a point where it's okay to be Catholic and it's okay to be atheist and it's okay to be this, which is what America was supposed to be founded on, that we're all going to get right. along. We're going to create a system in which right. we can all coexist. And, you know, we need yeah. churches in this country. We need government institutions in this country. And it sure would be nice if everything was cooperating in a way that was beneficial instead of constantly in battle. And I think that that's what's being created by this whole culture that we've got.
Yeah.
Now I'm digressing way far away.
No, but you make me think, I probably mentioned this here before since I let it all hang out. We've talked for 16 shows now, or mm-hmm. this is 16. But, you know, as I said, my parents were atheists, but they weren't those angry atheists, those militant atheists. They just were like, you know, to me, they were the true atheists. They're mm-hmm. like, talking about Jesus is as stupid as talking about Apollo or Zeus. It's a story.
Mm-hmm.
Move on. Why waste your time on it? And so they didn't bother with that. But on the other hand, then you think about it and go, but they raised us to be good people. It was just the school of, as long as you're not hurting anybody else, do whatever you want, which isn't really a healthy way to live, as they found out as they got older, and certainly as we, their children, found out as we went through life in the, you know, 70s growing mm-hmm. up. But and so you look at, where did they get all those ideas of how to be a good person? Well, that's Judeo-Christian society. Mm-hmm. And it's also that natural law that's built within us. Christopher Hitchens is never going to get rid of guilt. That's built in. It's called a conscience. That's the little voice that says, I shouldn't be doing this or I shouldn't be doing that. And I don't know what he's angry about underneath everything. Because that was the thing I loved, too, about Inception mm-hmm. was – they're like, okay, we have to plant. How do you plant the idea for someone to break up their business? You can't do it like that. And what you see is them tracing that cause down to a root idea
mm-hmm.
of what makes somebody act. And then what it comes down to, it's not a bit, who cares about the business thing? That's the thing anybody will go, don't tell me what to do. It's that level of, how is his relationship with his father? It comes back to personal relationship. And it's like, well, we could have him do it as a kind of a screw you impulse. And I'm quoting the movie here, people.
Mm.
But Cobb then says, no, positive emotion trumps negative emotion always. And, you know, he's picked that up because his guilt defines him.
Mm-hmm.
He had the negative, he planted the negative idea, this is not your world, this is not reality. Instead of probably saying, there is, you know, our children are waiting for us somewhere, or whatever he would have done instead. But he eschews that negative thing. He's always going to be positive. He's given the chance to kill Lucas Haas early on after he finds out he's been betrayed. He's like, no, I don't do that. You know, anytime something like that comes up, he's, no, we're not killing anyone. We're not going to follow the negative path.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is, and he says himself, he says, we all yearn for reconciliation. Let's find out about him and the father. He says that we all yearn.
Wow,
for reconciliation.
I missed that line. Yeah,
well,
he said that. That is
third
awesome.
Time through. Yeah, yeah. In yeah. fact, I think what I wrote down is positive emotion trumps negative emotion. We all yearn for reconciliation.
Wow.
And then, so then, when they got to the end of the movie, when he goes, I'm sorry to skip around some more, but he goes back to find Ken Watanabe, and I know this wasn't built in on purpose, but when you think about the fact, which is what we're talking about, that there are splinters of a huge truth, a huge story in every story we tell. To me, this was a splinter of a story I know more personally, which is he goes down to the depths of hell, basically, mm-hmm. to subconscious to rescue Ken Watanabe's character. And
yes,
he does it because he promised him he would.
Mm-hmm.
He also does it because that's the only way to get back to his kids. But at the base of it, by that time, you get the feeling of he's going to rescue him.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what. So he goes to the depths of hell. He takes the leap of faith. And he and this character have several times back and forth said, well, are you going to take a leap of faith or become an old man filled with regret, waiting to die alone? And so at the end, he says, I have come back for you. Or maybe Ken Watanabe by that time says, you've come back for me. He says, yes, to take a leap of faith. And he says, come back. So we can be young men together again.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry that I didn't realize this movie got to me this much. So I started talking about it, but it's the thing of Christ took that leap for us. He's God.
Mm-hmm.
And he came down here to be with us and go through all that. And also I've been writing this thing about Lent, so I'm super into it right now. But to bring us back so that we can be young men together again.
Right.
After we die, you know, he won't let us. If you take that leap of faith, he's not going to let you die filled with regret. You go back with him.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, that's, I'm sure, a primal thing and story. But there's Christians will look at it as Christ tells the original story. He is story with a capital S, so that's why those splinters of light show him to us, which is also why the church can say, you don't have to be Catholic, you don't have to be Christian to wind up in heaven, because Christ is revealed through nature, he's revealed through other ways. If you didn't have any other way to find out the truth, God's there for you.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I took a huge left turn.
Goodness, no reason to be sorry. But you're right, you know, and that's a huge part of that's something that I really like about the Catholic Church and was really happy to find out was what you just said about, you know, our belief is not that you have to do this and you have to be this to be saved.
Right.
This is not the only way. This is
it's the main line.
Right. the way that I view it, and hopefully this is valid, but you'll let me know, is that the Catholic Church is got everything that Christ intended to give us. It's got the whole enchilada.
Right.
And you know, everything else, like you know, using the word splinters, you know, or splinters of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
But the Catholic Church has everything. So,
right. And all that everything that it's got is solely intended or in its pure form. And people can take anything and make it what it's not supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, but all those sacraments, all that stuff it's got is purely intended to bring us face to face with a personal relationship with God so that we can get to heaven and where we're all supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
If all you have is splinters, it's going to be a lot harder for you to get there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're living somewhere where you've never heard of any of this and you're a nature worshiper, it's going to be harder to get there, but you will get there because St. Augustine said, you've got nature, you've got the sky, you've got the earth, you've got the sea. You, everywhere you are is a book that God wrote for you to read him in,
mm-hmm.
which is why science is so, you know, which is why to say science and religion are opposites is wrong. And I know we've said this before, but that's the point of that. The more those scientists who are Christians, they're the ones who say that. They're like, oh my gosh, look at this order that's under everything. It's planned.
Right, right.
Again, we can't wait
to talk more about that during our contact show.
Oh, yes. Well, we'll reserve that. But yeah, but that whole thing about that hadn't struck me before until I was watching the third time thinking about talking about it here. But that primal, are you going to take a leap of faith or become an old man filled with regret waiting to die alone?
Mm-hmm.
And I just looked at that and went, oh my gosh, that was my father.
Mm-hmm.
Never would take a leap of faith.
Yeah.
And he did become an old man filled with regret. And the only reason he wasn't waiting to die alone, and I don't want to sound like I'm a hero because I'm not, but a lot of what I was doing because I was like, the only way I can show Christ to him is through my actions. He's not going to listen to my words. And my brother and sister showed up, and my mother was stuck with him through. And he was not an easy guy to love. He was extremely unpleasant, and he shoved us away as hard as he could. But it was because we were all there determined, especially we siblings, to make sure that he at least had the basic knowledge of there is God and there is more, that we did wind up being able to talk to him about it. Hmm. He took that leap of faith before he died.
There's
some primal truths in this, however you want to interpret it. I mean, that love is worth anything and you shouldn't settle for less, that there is an ultimate truth and you have to keep diving deep, I guess, to find it.
Yeah.
That guilt is a prison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another way that I thought about this movie was all of those layers of dreams as things that we use to cover up reality. Because there are a lot of things that we do that pushes God farther away because we put lots of things in between us and him. And to me, as they were climbing back up to what was reality, that made me think of that. You know, there's a lot of things that we could strip away or that need to be stripped away so that we know what reality is. Because there's a lot of fooling ourselves going on right now about what's real and what's not real.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
Mm-hmm.
Is there? Oh, and think of, that's good. I hadn't thought of that. The fact that, because I love the scene where they suddenly, at the very bottom, the kick goes in and you start seeing them waking up through the layers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's like a dominoes or something.
Yeah, yeah.
That's good. I hadn't thought of that waking up to what reality really is, because they're getting back to the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the true world.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, that's
right. And it's all one thing, really. I mean,
supposed
to be.
Yeah,
but
well, yeah.
We give ourselves a lot of obstacles, don't we?
We do. And it's a funny thing because we lie to ourselves and then we make ourselves believe it's true. And it takes me back to this thing is my mom had an operation and it was bowel resectioning or something anyway. And she's not allowed to eat any fiber for like 6 months. Well, it's summer and she's like doing things like, I only ate a couple of cherry tomatoes, as she's lying there sick as a dog for 2 days afterwards, right?
Mm-hmm.
And after about the fourth time this happened, she's living with my sister, and my sister's going, look, Mom, you can lie to yourself, your brain, you can tell your brain whatever you want, but your bowel doesn't care. It knows one truth. You do this, it's going to tell you that was wrong. And it kind of comes back to me as, you know, we like to make excuses for all kinds of things, whether it's eating a piece of candy or not taking a walk or, you know, just the basic things of life. I don't understand why I can't lose weight or, you know, why I can't do whatever. And we're acting in a way that's directly contradictory to it. We're telling ourselves it's okay.
Right, right.
And that's why then I guess we wind up so unhappy.
I think so. I think you're absolutely correct.
And you're right. We need the kick to come back to where we should be. It's like the prodigal son lying to himself until he got down to that pig pen and went, you know, I could be living like a king if I would only admit I was wrong.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing that was kind of interesting was that train that kept coming to take him back to reality. That kept barging in everywhere.
Right, right.
Because I had been confused in that, you know, they're driving along on the first level of this big heist, and here comes this huge train barging through, and I'm like, I always thought that was part of Robert Fisher's defenses.
Oh, no.
Yeah, because what happens is they start going, oh, until someone starts driving a train through, and he immediately deflects it by going, well, what the heck's going on with those armed gunmen? Like, well, he must have been trained. And so he just goes into this rage. And this time I was like, well, but he was using the train, too. And they're like, no. My family's going, no. That's his. That's Cobb's train. That, and I went, oh, so reality keeps barging in whether he wants it to or not.
Mm-hmm.
And guilt, but...
Yeah, in the form of a big giant train that you have to yell to talk over.
Yeah.
But yet we're ignoring it.
Yeah, that he's deflecting. So everybody gets off on another topic of deflecting, being him being mad at them because this guy's trained to fight off attackers.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, it's not going to work. And they're like, and everybody then ignores the fact that he's already sabotaged them by not being honest.
Yeah. Except for Mal. No, not Mal. Ariadne. Ariadne. Who we haven't talked about.
No,
yeah,
we haven't.
Yeah, Ariadne, the architect of dreams, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you said, you know, Levitt said, you know, hey, I'm like a producer. I guess Ariadne would be the author.
She would take. She took the idea and she would spin it into... reality. She had to know what the dreamers' minds were like.
Mm-hmm.
So then she could construct something that would reflect their mind and also achieve what they wanted in terms of being able to gain access to this person's identity.
Right. Yeah. And there was a meaning to her name. Yeah. You sent me this thing from mythology.
Mm-hmm.
She had something to do with pulling someone out of a maze.
Was it Theseus?
I don't have it in front of me.
I don't know his name, but it's basically, the Minotaur who's in the middle of the maze. This Theseus has got to go kill him because otherwise the king of Minos, if that's how you say it, is extracting a tribute of young Greek men and women to kill every year as a sacrifice. Oh, well, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about the sacrifice part, but she is the king's daughter and she falls in love with him. And so she gives him, he says, I'll tell you how to get through here. I'm going to hold the red yarn or tie it at one end. You follow it back through the maze.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you find your way back out. So all the names didn't have significance, but that one did. Yeah. And then also Mal means bad, as we pointed out in the Serenity.
Right, right. Yep.
I also liked the idea that at the big climax of Cobb having to come face to face with what's real when his wife says, I'm the only thing you believe in anymore. And he suddenly gives this beautiful speech about, no, I wish more than anything, you're a shade, you're a shadow. You could never be her with all her perfection, all her quirks, all her imperfections. Because she was so much more complex than you could ever be.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. That was that tribute to all the good and bad that makes each person the things that they are.
Yeah, right.
That you can never hold in your memories.
Yeah.
And that, you know, your memories intensify the good and the bad, which is what he was doing.
Right, absolutely. Yep. Yeah, and that was the scene where he finally let go of that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
He had to face it. It was the ultimate choice. Stay there with them. Because that's when she says, well, you can see their faces now. And he's looking at the table going, no, I won't do it. That's not true. I'm not going to stay here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then,
you know, I just keep getting struck, you know, as you say that. And I thought in that movie, too, it's a point of meaninglessness, that mm-hmm. he realizes what I'm doing is meaningless. And no matter how much fun he's having, mm-hmm. and no matter how much he's enjoying it, the mm-hmm. meaninglessness takes everything out of what he's doing.
Right.
And he, you know, you despair or you try and change it. His wife despaired and he tried to change it, I guess.
Yeah, because the thing he was the maddest at her about was she left him and she left their children.
Mm-hmm.
She abandoned them. And he, I think, in addition to his love and his need to get back to his children, he wasn't going to abandon them. And he knew that one thing he could really hold on to was he knew that was true.
Mm-hmm.
But he had to let go of his guilt. And I think that's why he's able to, that's the deeper meaning of why he can walk by the top. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just starting to wobble. And to me, that means it's going to go down because otherwise it wouldn't wobble at all. But he knows it's true. Mm-hmm. Deep down, we know. You know, we may not know why, but if you're miserable and unhappy, you know something is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you resort to alcohol or drugs or overeating or being awful to people or any combination of all kinds of unpleasant behavior. What was it that I just was reading or listening to where it was saying that it might have been Stephen Tobolowsky,
mm-hmm.
the Tobolowsky Files,
mm-hmm.
where he was talking about, somebody was anyway, they were acting all the ways that you act when you're really unhappy and have a lack of love, and they're all unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I could remember where I saw that or heard that, but
yeah.
And I was really struck, and it was like, yeah, none of those are ever pleasant ways to act.
Yeah, for certain.
Because something's out of kilter, and we know it, even if we can't articulate it. He could articulate it, because there we were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, fantastic. Great movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great movie. Lots of meaning. So
yeah. I don't know if all this talking
and
was to the point or not.
And not only that, it's just plain cool. I mean,
oh my gosh.
The scene where Ariadne first goes into the dream and starts messing around in there.
Oh,
I
yeah.
loved it. Oh, I thought it was terrific.
Yeah.
She starts bending. What happens if I do this? And I thought that was neat.
Yeah, the thing with the mirrors, where suddenly there are mirrors there and she's pulling them. And
yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And then bending the street so it moves right on top. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was cool too.
Or she picked it up really fast. I also like the point that they make about, you know, when you're in a dream, you never remember how you got there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was the thing I was going to tell you that I was emailing yesterday, where I was suddenly like, you know what? The other reason it's on a dream is he knows how he got there.
Yeah. Right.
Look at everything he went through to get there. I guess mm-hmm. the fact that they start the scene with him walking down the hall, but, you mm-hmm. know, his father had been with him.
Yeah.
His father's in the
Picked
scene.
Picked him up at the airport, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He knows how he got there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I was reading something that said, you know, where somebody had analyzed it to the point of, was he wearing his wedding ring or not wearing his wedding ring? What kind of shoes did he have on? I was like, wow, that's too much analysis. Because in the end, it doesn't matter if you care about all the stuff that we're saying or not. Those are all elements that make a fantastic movie. There's meaning. You care about what the hero is going to get out of it at the end. It's like four James Bond movies in one.
Mm-hmm.
The chase scenes, the breaking into places, oh my gosh, how about the free fall?
Oh, yeah.
Fight that Gordon Levitt gets to do.
How am I like, going to do this without gravity? Chase. That was awesome. Yeah.
And that I'll lead them a merry chase. And it's the only time that he and Ames ever get along.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yep. All fantastic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Great movie.
Mm-hmm.
5 stars.
Oh, yes, definitely. It's in my pool room. Already.
It's in the pool room. All right.
Yes. Yes.
I love it. I love
definitely.
It.
Definitely.
In the pool room.
And also, I would like to recommend the score.
Yeah. Yeah.
I only have the main song, which Rose bought and put on our home computer, so I have it. It's called Time by Hans Zimmer, and it's when you listen to it, you know, it's this melancholy thing. It's very evocative. You can immediately see part of the movie in your mind when you hear it. But it's the way he builds it up from a piano to adding the violins. Suddenly these horns come blaring in. You're just like, how did he do this? It's brilliant. So
mm-hmm.
I would like to recommend the score.
Very cool.
Like yeah. Hans Zimmer.
All right.
Which I do. I think he's of the Bernard Herrmann school of, you know, he did all those Psycho, North by Northwest. He did a lot of Alfred Hitchcock's stuff.
Nice.
Which you may, I don't know if you know him or not, but.
I don't think I do. Didn't Hans Zimmer have something to do with Pirates of the Caribbean?
He may have. I don't know.
I can't
remember
for positive, but.
All the Batman movies. I mean, he's obviously worked with Christopher Nolan a lot.
Oh, okay, cool.
He's one of those people kind of like, who's the other guy I really like who works with M. Night Shyamalan? Is that how you say his name?
Yeah.
Until he, you know, kind of went wonky on us. But Howard Newton, something like that. He's kind of similar too, and you can hear Bernard Herrmann's influence there, where he can do regular tunes, but he does a lot of things that, like the Psycho music, you know, using instruments in a way that's not traditionally music, but very evocative for what you're watching. And he did a lot of Twilight Zone soundtrack stuff too. He did tons of TV work.
Oh, cool.
When you start looking around, you see he did all kinds of TV stuff. So,
Yeah, it says here that Wikipedia says Bruckheimer had finished shooting Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl, but was unhappy with the music composed for the film and wanted a replacement score, and then he hired Zimmer.
Ah, okay.
Let's see. To rescore the film, it goes on though. Bruckheimer wanted Zimmer to rescore the film, but due to his commitments on The Last Samurai, the task of composing and supervising music went to Klaus Badelt. So it looks like he was involved in some way, but not. And then Zimmer was hired as the composer for the three subsequent films, so he did the other three.
Okay, yeah. So that's where you've seen the name. Well, and that's interesting. So he did The Last Samurai. Yeah. And I've just recently started listening to soundtrack music more. And so interesting.
Yeah, very interesting.
Just, you know, it's the modern classical composition, really. Yeah, it's like, you know, in the old days they did opera. Now they do soundtracks.
Right,
you
know, right.
And you find some brilliant people, like Danny Elfman, I also like a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Not necessarily as the way he does the Tim Burton movies, because those tend to all sound alike. Because I think Tim Burton, he likes to do the same thing over and over again, but through different movies. I like Tim Burton, don't get me wrong. But, So it winds up with an identifiable sound, kind of like Randy Newman sometimes for Pixar.
Right, yeah.
Who also is good for different stuff.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
For certain.
Anyway.
Okay.
Beside the point.
All right. Let's see. What do we got coming up?
So next is Agatha Christie.
Oh, yes. And then there were none.
Something light and easy to watch or read.
Oh, that'll be fun. Yeah. Fantastic. Yep.
Yeah. And I thought I had a copy of it, but unless one of the girls has hijacked it, I guess I don't. I had to request it from the library.
Oh, cool.
So then are your selections.
Oh, yes. Then we're going to do Contact. Which I'm really looking forward to. Hope you enjoy that one.
And you've talked about it before. I've meant to watch it. So looking forward to it.
Cool. And then the book Declare by Tim Powers.
Yes, which I'm afraid of, but I'm going forward positively. Not kicking and screaming.
Fantastic. Yep.
And
October. Yes.
Yeah. So I was feeling after East of Eden and Inception were kind of more serious, even though good.
Yeah.
So I went light with that. Felt more whimsical. I'm not sure if you can call Something Wicked This Way Comes whimsical, but it's more fantastical, perhaps, in Ray Bradbury's language.
Right.
And concepts. And then, what movie was it?
Shaun of the Dead. That's right.
Yep. Of course. Because it's been too long since we've had any zombies.
That's right. And Simon Pegg with extra Simon Pegg.
Extra Simon Pegg. It's the movie. I'll say this again then, I guess. I've never, ever wanted to watch a zombie movie. I'm afraid of them. In horror movies, I like to know the jumps first before I see them. So, but this was the first movie that I was like, okay, I'm going to watch a zombie movie. I don't care. I have to see this.
So. Oh, cool.
And look what Fantastic. It did to me. Watch out. You warned everybody.
And now you're the resident zombie expert of Good Story is Hard to Find.
Yes. Well, I'm a terrible zombie expert because I only know facts about other zombie movies other than like Zombieland because I will not watch them unless you prescribe them for me.
Oh, I love it. That's funny. Maybe next October. We'll do Dawn yes. of the Dead or something.
Yes, we'll switch so that we'll be sure that you can get next October. And in fact, I've already chosen December stuff, but I'm not going to say
right.
it until after.
I've got
just
it, yeah.
A long time ago, I was like, oh, if I got to do December, here are the two things I'd get to do. So,
well, cool. Yeah, and I've got to decide on November, and I'm thinking, okay, yeah. Thanksgiving. You know, the only Thanksgiving movie I can think of is Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Oh, please don't do that.
I'm not going to, but I'm just saying that is the only Thanksgiving movie I can think of. Isn't that funny? You'd think that Thanksgiving would be the subject of a lot of a lot of movies, but
you'll just have to, maybe something families would watch together. Or...
Oh, sure. You bet.
Because our Thanksgiving tradition is, you know, we, for some reason, my family doesn't live near enough, and Tom's family all splits up to be with their kids or whatever. And so we have Tom's mom over and any friends that we can gather who don't have family around, but that's very few. And then after we watch the Cowboys game, which is a must, because why would anybody do anything else?
For sure.
Then we always watch some movie, but it's never a themed movie. It's just some movie that someone's like, I rented this, or, you know, the kids are home. So, you haven't seen this. We've got to watch it. So
that's
you can,
cool. Have you ever gone to a Cowboys game?
Oh, no, because I don't want to give up my Thanksgiving. Oh. But we have lots of friends and family who do.
Yeah, I was just curious, you know.
Yeah, they go and they leave like 10 o'clock in the morning and they do the tailgating out, you know, the Thanksgiving turkey legs.
Right, right.
Although I think at the new Cowboys Stadium, old Skinflint himself won't let people tailgate anymore. I mean,
are you kidding me?
I think that's what I remember
Holy cow.
Hearing. I was like, you know, first get the city to pay for something multi-million. Then charge.
Wow, what? Yeah, that's unbelievable.
That people have been going for 30 years can hardly afford them. Then do this, you know, like, who's it all about, Jerry Jones?
Oh, wow.
You want to know why nobody in Dallas really likes you?
Oh, boy.
Let's start with that,
yeah.
Not that I'm going to make it personal,
Yeah, me and my brother and brother-in-law flew down to Dallas for a game. This was years ago before I knew you. And we flew in, and one of the things I remember from Dallas Cowboys Stadium was the Jack Daniel's Slurpees that they had.
That might almost make it worth it for the trouble and expense to go, now that I think about it.
I was like, wow, Jack Daniel's Slurpee. Yeah.
Wow.
Don't have too many of those, to tell you what.
I know. Well, and actually now, I'd have to look into it, but now we've got the Metro going, or, you know, DART rail, as it's called, going to a lot more places, and they may actually now have one that goes by the stadium.
Oh.
So that would be something where I would go, okay, if I don't have to drive and park, I could, you know, catch the train really close to my house.
Wow.
Take that over. Because they're now expanding that to a lot of places. We have a guy who has given up using his car, and... He's using the rail.
Wow. Well, cool.
Which we encourage. So.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, have a good couple of weeks, everybody, and we'll be back with Agatha Christie.
Yeah. Oh, I know. A nice mystery. Easy reading.
Yeah. It'll be fun.
Yeah.
All right. We'll see you later, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.